My Sister Life, Second Birth, the poems of Dr. Zhivago, and the poems he was able to write after Dr. Zhivago and the few years left to him in his own name. Of his prose, they'd say there's one wonderful piece, his autobiographical piece of prose called Safe Conduct, which is about his adoration for two poets quite unlike himself, the German poet Rilke and the Russian poet Mayakovsky. It's an extraordinary piece of prose. But most Russians that I know find Dr. Zhivago not a great work and a very difficult work to read. They'll say there are wonderful bits in it. If you want to know what it was like to be a schoolboy and a student in Moscow just before the revolution, if you want to know what it feels like to be freezing and starving during a revolution, then that will convey it better than any other. There are wonderful descriptions of nature. But there is a terrible problem with plotting. I think it's very well plotted in the sense it's the characters appear and they keep on coming back. But when you look at, say, the villain, Khabarovsky, who not only seduces Lara, causes the suicide of Zhivago's father, and what's more, when frustrated, he kicks his own pet bulldog. Now, that's going a little too far. He's so much a stage villain.
He's a proper
Victorian.
Villain. He's a proper villain.
Yes, I like him, but it's a fault in characterization, I think.
Let's return to Pasternak's poems. I wanted to hear one more of Pasternak's poems, which is his poem on the Nobel Prize, which he was awarded in 1958 and which he turned down, or tried to turn down, in order to be allowed to continue to live and work in Russia. Adjoa.
All is lost. I'm a beast in a pen. There are people and freedom outside, but the hunters are already at hand, and I haven't a way to take flight. The bank of a pond, woods at night, and the trunk of the pine lying bare. I am trapped and cut off on each side. Come what comes, I simply don't care. Am I a murderer, a villain, a creep? Of what crime do I stand here condemned? The whole world listens, ready to weep to my words of my beautiful land. Even now, at the edge of the tomb, I believe in the virtuous fate, and the spirit of goodness will soon overcome all the malice and hate.
That was Nobel Prize, translated by Andrei Neller. Jonathan, it's a poem about deep compromise, isn't it?
I can't imagine the frustration of that moment, that it's not only the Nobel Prize, but I tell you what I would have been thinking at that time. I would have been thinking, oh, no, that's my first draft they're publishing over there. You know, and that is the problem. You kind of wish that he'd had a chance to work with an editor on this book. I think it would have been hugely improved with an editor. And, you know, it's the poor man's first draft.
And there are a lot of Russian novelists, one feels, could have done with editors, and others would say the very way in which Russian writers used to be paid by the line, not on a percentage of sales, was a reason for many defects. I'd only say about that poem there's an extraordinary parallel in the West, because when Nabokov wrote Lolita, and Lolita was condemned and banned, Nabokov wrote a poem in Russian on a very similar lines, what harm have I done with my little girl? Am I a paedophile? Am I exactly the same thought? Total puzzlement. And some of Pasternak's friends at the time said, you know, we sympathize, we know this novel had to be written, but you were very naive to think that you could get away with it.
But, and these are real questions, aren't they, Donald? I mean, I don't know what truth you think there is in it since, but some historians believe Pasternak actually to have been more radically compromised, to have been an agent of the KGB. I mean, in which case he would have been a murderer, villain, creep, as he questions in his poem.
I think there's a complete nonsense. There was no one, I think, who was less compromised than him. He had a way of talking which made it impossible for officials or secret policemen to get any sense out of him. They gave up. And they considered he was crazy. Even Stalin said, he lives in the clouds, leave him alone.
But that's all the more remarkable, considering there are some really rather good spy stories, at least CIA stories, around the publication.
Oh, yes, because the Soviets took their revenge not so much on Pasternak, but on the Italian publisher, Feltrinelli. Feltrinelli was a member of the Italian Communist Party, and the Russians forgot. Soviets forgot that he was an Italian first and a communist second, and he went ahead and published, despite all the requests not to. He was found blown up with an electricity pile and compromising documents proving him to be a fascist. Yes, that's where the spy stories come in.
Well, I was also told while researching it by someone whose father was on the Litchfield estate where he had his house, that the word there was that the mistress was a KGB informer. But of course, what she would have been informing on, I don't know. This.
One of the things that impressed me about re-seeing the film, which, as we know, was not filmed in Russia, it couldn't have been, and the snow was fake, and it was nonetheless one of those moments which made me fall in love with Russian landscape, because actually it's very much a novel about landscape and that sense of place and that sense of vastness. Do you think that's Pasternak in particular?
I don't think a Russian writer can write without doing that. I mean, and then, you know, Lean and his designers picked it up in the film. I mean, it just is always there in Russian writing.
And Pasternak's very good at landscape. Yeah. His best poems are just landscapes, poems about the steppe. He's wonderful at landscapes. I can only think of one Russian writer who's hopeless at landscapes, never tried, that's Dostoevsky. I don't think there's a single tree in Dostoevsky.
Right.
A blade of grass, it's completely urban. But every other writer, Turgenev, Tolstoy, Chekhov, they love landscape.
And those are the best bits in the novel. I mean, you know, like when Shivago is, walking back from the partisans to find Lara and that walk through there. Those are the bits that really come alive in the novel, and you think, this is what it takes.
Yeah, I agree with you, but those must have been the hardest to dramatise, landscape.
Oh, you just one line of narration, you're there. It's great.
I'm afraid that's where we have to leave it. Thank you very much to my guests, Jonathan Myerson and Donald Rayfield, to our reader, Adja Ando, and to all of you, our audience, here at the Royal College of Music, as well as to our listeners on Radio 3.
Susan Hitch was talking to the writer Jonathan Myerson and Donald Rayfield, Professor of Russian at Queen Mary University of London. The reader was Adja Ando, and the programme was produced by Natalie Steed. And just across the way from the Royal College of Music, here in the Royal Albert Hall, this evening's prom continues live on BBC Radio 3 with the second part of our concert celebrating two Russian innovators, Scriabin and Stravinsky. We're about to hear the work that made the younger man's name, Stravinsky's ballet The Firebird, whose Paris premiere in 1910 created a sensation. A century later, it's still a huge draw, as the London Symphony Orchestra and its principal conductor Valery Gergiev are proving this evening. And perhaps it's not too fanciful to suggest that Scriabin's sensuously exotic orchestral writing found a way into Stravinsky's first ballet in the music depicting the Firebird itself. But as Valery Gergiev was keen to point out to me earlier, it's really Rimsky-Korsakov's fingerprints that are all over the Firebird. Rimsky set his pupil orchestration exercises based on his latest operas, which were being prepared for the Mariinsky Theatre. We're going to hear the complete ballet score, and not just one of the suites from it, and that matters a great deal to Valery Gergiev.
The whole score tells the story. You tell the story where the suite brings the brilliant elements in a compact form of 20-something minutes, and you can really excite audiences with the suite. But if you want to follow the story, and if orchestra has these colors, and if I may say, understanding of the theatricality of the score, because you cannot play this score as a objective instrumental writing. It's just technical brilliancy to be displayed. So conductor has to inspire orchestra in a way that everyone becomes, if needed, a dancer, if needed, a very monstrous creature, if needed, a very young and very elegant girl who moves on stage, or this famous dance of Firebird. I mean, you have to really imagine how it can be staged in the theater on stage, how it can look. So when you have an idea, it maybe also sound better. That's how I think. And yes, I have experience to conduct this score in the theater. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And we even keep historical production, Fokin. And of course, there are wonderful traditions we at the Mariinsky don't want to remove.
Valery Gergiev. And Stravinsky's connections with the Mariinsky Theatre are stronger than you might realise, not just through the famous productions of his works that they preserve, like this one, or through the operas of his teacher Rimsky-Korsakov, but through his own father, Fyodor Stravinsky. He was a principal bass baritone at the Mariinsky Opera, and the family lived in a flat just around the corner from the theatre in St. Petersburg, until Stravinsky was married, and the Firebird flew him to France for that fairy tale success. And what of the fairy tale itself? It was actually the choice of Serge Diaghilev, who chose the story before he decided on the composer who'd write the music for his dance company, the Ballet Russe. In the garden of the demon king Kashchei the Immortal, the Firebird appears, chased by Prince Ivan, who catches her and only releases her in exchange for a magic feather. 13 princesses come out of Kashchei's castle and play with the golden apples from an enchanted tree until Ivan appears and falls for the most beautiful princess. Dawn is breaking and the girls have to return, and as Ivan tries to follow, Kashchei's monsters seize him, and Kashchei himself tries to bewitch the prince. But Ivan has the magic feather and summons the Firebird, whose own magic makes Kashchei's followers dance themselves to exhaustion. And as they sleep, the Firebird shows Ivan the egg which contains Kashchei's soul. The prince smashes it. Kashchei dies, his magical creatures vanish, and all his captives are released. Ivan and the most beautiful princess are married amidst general rejoicing. Well, Stravinsky was an unknown outside Russia at the time, although by the time Diaghilev thought he'd try him out for the Ballet Russe, Stravinsky had already had two early orchestral works performed, the Scherzo Fantastique and his Fireworks. And it seems to have been the St. Petersburg performance of the Scherzo in 1909 that made Diaghilev's ears prick up. He must have been delighted with the results of his gamble on this young composer. Stravinsky's score, Bakst's designs, and Fokine's choreography made for an intoxicating Firebird in Paris, conducted by Gabriel Pierney, with one of the critics acclaiming the most exquisite marvel of equilibrium that we've ever imagined between sounds, movements, and forms. Stravinsky, though, rather turned against the Firebird later on. Its international popularity meant that there were constant requests to conduct and perform it when he'd rather have been conducting other things. And here comes Valery Gergiev to conduct Stravinsky's The Firebird, a century after its Paris premiere in June 1910.
Thank you.
And they all lived happily ever after. General rejoicing at Prince Ivan's wedding to his princess and the freedom of Kashchei's captives at the end of The Firebird by Igor Stravinsky. Which may have been begun rather nervously at the behest of Serge Diaghilev for his Ballet Russe, but which made Stravinsky an overnight sensation in Paris after the first performance 100 years ago. And what a reception for this evening's conductor. Here he comes, Valery Gergiev. We've just heard Firebird as he thinks it should be heard, complete. The only way to get a full sense of the story, he says, brought so colourfully to life here in the Royal Albert Hall by the players of the London Symphony Orchestra, including the offstage element that's required for the complete Firebird. Wagner tubas, three trumpets and percussion. The trumpets reappearing at the back of the stage to add their weight and colour to that final blaze of triumph. Well, we know what happened next for Stravinsky. The next two great Russian ballets for Diaghilev, Petrushka in 1911, then the scandalous success of The Rite of Spring, whose pagan ritual incensed and entranced audiences in Paris in 1913. And you'll be able to experience it for yourself at the Proms later this season. And here come the calls for the individual members of the LSO. That one for bassoonist Rachel Goff. Oboist Emmanuel Aboul. Baronettist Andrew Mariner there. And flautist Gareth Davis. Shouldn't forget the piccolo playing with Sharon Williams. There's the whole of the heavy brass, the trombones and tuba on their feet. And I think we must have missed David Pyatt, the principal horn player, when Gergiev first came on. Some superb playing from all of them. Gergiev shakes hands with principal viola player Paul Silverthorne, cellist Timothy Hugh, and now the LSO's leader, Roman Simovic. The whole orchestra on its feet now. It's the LSO's only prom this season, Gergiev's second and last. And next he's taking the LSO to perform Mahler's Fifth Symphony in Gestalt before joining up with his Mariinsky Orchestra for performances in Vienna and Stockholm, and then comes his own festival in Rotterdam, I think. And there are more opportunities to unpick the various threads of late 19th and 20th century Russian music this week. Stravinsky's teacher, Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, alongside Tchaikovsky's Second Symphony on Thursday. And tomorrow evening at the Proms, a key Soviet symphony by someone who represents to some the opposite of Scriabin's influence in Russian music, Dmitri Shostakovich. His Fifth Symphony from the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Edward Gardner. Russian violinist Alina Ibrahimova joins them for the world premiere of a new violin concerto by Hugh Watkins, and there's music by Arvo Pärt and Benjamin Britten in the first half. That's live here on BBC Radio 3 from 7 tomorrow. But here in the Royal Albert Hall tonight, the cheers are continuing. Even if Kashchei's spells have been broken, the enchantment cast by Stravinsky's Firebird has started stretching into its second century. And back in his own magic kingdom in Broadcasting House, here's Jonathan Swain.
Thank you very much indeed, Andrew. Andrew McGregor there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, as well as the BBC iPlayer for listening again, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom broadcast in its entirety again next Monday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3 at 2 o'clock. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then why not go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer prom season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, back to this evening, and in a couple of minutes' time, the Lebrecht interview tonight. Norman Lebrecht talking to the American mezzo Joyce DiDonato, famous for her Rossini and Handel, and also for her engaging powers of communication, singing and talking ones. That's at 9:45 or just after. And after it at 10:30, tonight's tomorrow night's prom soloist, the violinist Alina Ibragimova, tonight playing Bach, one of the unaccompanied violin sonatas. Alina is one of the many international stars to have graduated from the BBC Radio 3 New Generation Artists scheme. Her father, by the way, Renat, is principal double bass player with the London Symphony Orchestra, who we've just been listening to. Old French song from Tchaikovsky's album for the young. The pianist there was Victoria Postnikova. This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 10:15. And now time for the Norman Lebrecht interview.
Joyce DiDonato is one of those singers who, riding high in an opera career, suddenly explodes into mass fame by a freak combination of fate and her own fortitude. In Joyce's case, she broke a leg last year in the first act of Rossini's Barbara of Seville at the Royal Opera House in London. But instead of being ambulanced to hospital, she insisted on staying on, singing out the opening night with the help of a stick and a crutch, and she then returned in a pink cast and wheelchair to perform the rest of the run. Such courage and determination is rare in a profession where two sneezes can be cause for cancellation. Over the years since her accident, DiDonato has won celebrity as a real heroine rather than a stage one. The sixth child in an Irish Catholic family in Prairie Village, Kansas, she married young and was almost 30 before anyone was prepared to back her. In the decades since then, she's taken on mezzo roles in Rossini and Handel with a wide-eyed zest that audiences find irresistible, an openness that appears to be innate. She writes a chatty, cheerful blog and decorates it with photographs that she snaps wherever she goes. She's the very model of a 21st century communicator. We meet in Milan, where she's singing tonight in the Barber of Seville. Joyce DiDonato, you seem so natural on stage, almost to the manner born.
Oh, well, I feel very much at home on this stage. It's a place that I love to be, and I have found that it's an incredible teacher to me. So I welcome the chance to be on there. I suppose I welcome the chance to play the fool every once in a while. And
show a lot of yourself, though, on stage, in role. You do seem to be wide open.
I do, but I think I've learned that. I had a natural ability to go out on stage and impress as an actress, but it wasn't always real. It was sometimes done in a very showy way.
From what age?
High school. Mm-hmm. I loved being on the stage. It was only, I think, by actually doing this a lot and being on my own and wanting to be better that I was able to start peeling away some of the layers around me and, I think, become a more honest performer, where I wasn't trying to impress so much and make a big impression, but really trying to find the truth of the character and let more of myself show through. But that's been a process, and I think it will continue, I hope.
And you felt that being on stage was the most of you, that this actually brought you out of yourself, out of your shell, out of being the prairie girl?
Yes. A few years ago, after 9/11, I remember in particular, I think everybody's world shifted a little bit at that time, and I realized the only place I really felt alive and free was on the stage. And I had just enough comprehension of the world of the theater and opera to know that that was an explosively dangerous thing, because it would become more and more of a drug. It would be the only place that I found any kind of contentment or happiness. And I thought, whoa, I do not want this for my life. And I would say I was, you know, maybe 32, 33 at the time, my early 30s when all of this process was going through. And I made a very, very distinct decision that I had to do the work in my life to find that freedom and happiness in my life, because ultimately that's what lasts, hopefully. But that's why I say the stage has been a teacher, because it showed me the kind of freedom that was possible in myself, freedom of myself and expression. And I used that as a beacon to try and help me find that in my day-to-day life. And it's a work in progress, you know, as my life on the stage is as well. But I think I backed off of that cliff of the stage being the only thing in my life that provided release. And now I can go to it with a different kind of freedom. I don't need the stage the way I did back then. For me, it's a gift. I come and it's just simply a place to express and live and enjoy life, but it's not the only place that I have that.
Because you have happiness and balance in your life.
That's what I work for, yeah.
Prairie Village, Kansas. Is it as it sounds?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it really is sort of a small town. What it is it's a suburb of the metropolitan Kansas City area. And it's, you know, a lot of sort of cookie cutter houses, and all the lawns are kept very well. When I was growing up, it was very middle class neighborhood. And, you know, we were sort of on the lower end of the middle class there growing up. But, you know, our church and my school was a block away. The grocery store was another block in the other direction. Everything was central right around there. So it was a village in that sense. But the prairie part, thankfully, was not too much in existence. It was a real functioning suburb.
But you're 1,000 miles from any ocean, any sea.
Yes.
You're really in the middle of America, about as middle as it's possible to be.
Completely. And it's an ocean of land, not of water, where we were.
Did you ever feel trapped inland? Did you ever feel as a child a need to get away from that, to get out?
I think, you know, growing up, no, it's what I knew. It was normal for me. But when I went to college at Wichita, Kansas, which was even more in the middle of Kansas than Kansas City is. And it's really in the middle of nowhere. I went to college to be a teacher. And so my path was very clear. I was very certain I would be a high school music teacher. I would probably move back to Kansas City and teach in a local, probably Catholic high school. That was my certain future at that point. And I got sidetracked into this opera thing. And through that world, all of a sudden, my kaleidoscope just really, really opened up. And I started doing a few competitions outside the state of Kansas. I took a trip to New York City to study with a very famous teacher for 2 lessons. And really, it was if the blinder just flew off and I went, oh, there's a whole world out here. There's different kinds of people. And even the world of opera itself, with these stories and the librettos and the world that was created around these operas, my life really exploded, I think.
And your home is still in Kansas?
My home is still Kansas City. It's the buckle of the Bible Belt.
And when did you last see your home?
I'm trying to remember. I think it was January. A friend of mine is a blogger, and she asked me to do a guest interview on her blog, and it was about travel in this business. And she said, last year, how many days did you spend at home? And I counted it up. It was 32 days in my home. And it was not consecutive, I will say. It was sometimes 2 days or 3 days dropping off luggage and doing laundry. I think the longest span was 6 or 7 days, but I was home for 32 days. That's crazy.
Sounds like things are going well.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for.
When you struck out into the big world, Wichita State University, Philadelphia Academy of Vocal Arts, it was a big step. Did you feel like the girl from Hicksville?
I completely felt like the girl from Hicksville. And every so often, I still do, actually. but now I can laugh at it and not apologize for it. I was overwhelmed moving to Philadelphia. I was married at the time.
You married very young, while you were at college?
Yeah, well, we met, my first husband, we met my freshman year in college. It's a very Midwestern thing, you know, and we dated all through college. And like everybody else, we got married that first summer. I think I was 22.
Oh, I've seen the movie.
Yeah, haven't we?
Many times.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, he is a wonderful person.
And an Italian?
American-Italian,
right.
But with Italian
and musician?
No, big sports guy and a travel agent, actually. And is really, really one of the most wonderful human beings I've ever met. But I think I didn't have a clue who I was. I think he did, actually. He has always been a very secure person in who he was. But I didn't know anything. I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't really know what was important to me. Who I was, you know, all those things at 22, you're certain that you do know at that time, of course. And so, you know, things just sort of played out in a way that I didn't expect them to. But I had to sort of follow where I was going and the way I was evolving as a person. But we moved to Philadelphia with no money. At AVA at that time, your tuition was paid for, which was quite an extraordinary thing because we had coachings every day, voice lessons every week. You know, I mean, it was at that time a $30,000 tuition, but we had to pay for our living. There were no stipends or anything. So I was working as a choir director and as a waitress at the same time going to the academy full time. It was quite a bohemian existence. Mm. Yeah. I was thrust into this crazy, intense, competitive world, and it took me a few years to get my footing there. It was a very tough experience, psychologically in particular, because it was a very grueling training. And at the time, I didn't understand it. I look back on it now, and it's the best thing that probably could have happened to me, because constantly I had to keep deciding, do I really want to go for this? And do I think I have something to offer? Because I was not necessarily built up in that place. I was the Kate Pinkerton. And I was the lover in Il Tabarro. You know, I didn't really get a... I sang Adora Bello there, which was lovely. But I had to really, really fight because nobody was really my champion there. I had to find something in myself that gave me the will to keep going and to keep trying, even if it wasn't a sure thing, because I was not the golden child there.
And what was that something? Because you were also fighting your own self-doubt.
Absolutely. And not to be diminished, my vocal technique. I didn't really know how to sing yet. I was going sort of on instinct and crossing my fingers that the high notes would come, and often they didn't. But I had something in me that I thought merited the attention. I had a really strong desire to communicate. I had a really, really strong desire to sing this music. And I also felt I had all of this inside of me, but nobody was seeing it. Nobody was getting it. I was like, well, I've got that inside of me. Why didn't I win the competition? Or why didn't they give me that role? And I thought, well, it's obviously stuck inside of me. It's not being communicated to the people that need to get it. So I kept working, and I kept searching, and I kept working, and I kept searching, and I kept working. And I think that has been a quality that has served me really well, because I'm not afraid of work. And I know that even now, you know, I have a good resume, I've got work coming for the next couple of years, I'm in a good place, but the work isn't finished. And I know that that's been a quality that has served me really well.
Is that a kind of faith? A sense of destiny?
Sometimes I think so.
That you were made for this?
Yes, sometimes I do feel like I just have to step back and say, I'm doing what I'm meant to be doing.
And who's telling you this?
I think the bottom line for me is that it's myself, because when I'm in the groove and when I am really doing the work, and it can be in a rehearsal, it can be at a piano by myself, it can be in front of the Milanese public at La Scala, or it can be at a private charity concert in a living room somewhere, it's easy. And that doesn't mean the work is easy and that the singing is easy. It just means there's a flow to it. And that tells me that I'm not fighting a losing battle, and I'm not fighting obstacles that are being thrown at me. And I think when somebody, you know, you watch a great sports person, I love sports, and there's so many parallels to what we do, but you watch Federer hit a tennis ball, and you just know there's a lot of work behind what he does, but it's easy. He's exactly where he's supposed to be. So I feel that for myself. But also, the important thing as a performer is I feel that also from the audience. If the audience didn't get what I was doing, it would tell me probably that I'm also not in the right field. And not everybody gets me or loves my singing, and that's fine. We're in a very subjective category. But at the end of the day, you know, people write me, or the applause at the end is rather heartfelt and overwhelming. And that tells me that I'm touching them in some way, or the music via my vocal cords is touching them. And so if I didn't feel that that element was there as well, I would walk away.
That's very well put. I don't think Federer could have put it better. Houston Grand Opera, that was your first job, wasn't it? And the voice teacher, Steve Smith, told you to forget everything you'd learned and start again from scratch.
Yes.
That must have been tough.
It was.
It's pretty brutal as well.
Well, at the same time, it was so frightening and scary. On the equal side of that, it was so liberating. I was 26 when I started that program. And at that time, a lot of my colleagues who were 24, 25, 26, 27 were already getting covers at the Met, singing starring roles at City Opera, having management, you know, winning competitions. And I was starting to feel a bit behind. But I also knew, again, going back, I had all this expressive desire, but I didn't have the technique, and I could feel that. So I thought, he's found me out. He found out that I don't know what I'm doing. Come to find out, I think I was much more the rule than the exception. I think there are very few 25 or 26-year-olds that really know what they're doing. And we see that. We see these people shoot out of the gate, and 28, 29, 30 hits, and they start falling apart. And sadly, we've seen some very high-profile cases of that, and it's heartbreaking. Because if you're in the thick of things, how do you take time off and fix a problem? For me, the first lesson, the exact quote he told me is, he'd vocalized me for about 4 minutes on some ahs. And he said, look, I'm direct. And come to find out, that's a quality I think I appreciate more than anything. Because in this business, who has time to be lied to? Oh, you sound great. That was fabulous. And you're like, thank you very much. And you know people are lying to you. You know, I'd rather have the straight story. Why didn't I get the job? Why did I get a bad review? Tell me what I need to work on. And then I can be proactive about it. So the fact that he was so direct with me, I think, shocked me at first. And then I thought, oh, well, now we can actually work. So he said, Joyce, you're musical. I think you're intelligent, talented, but there's no future in what you're doing. You are singing on youth and muscle, and that's going to last you about another 4 years. And the load that went off my shoulders was huge, because I thought, oh my God, he knows I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I would cross my fingers and stick them behind my back going through my passaggio, hoping I could manage it, you know. And he said, if you trust me, we can do this. I said, okay. And from that first lesson, I to this day told him I feel like I got completely naked in front of him, because he took away all the tricks that I was using to sing. My tongue was like iron, and my jaw had to be set to just create this sound and push out, try and get the buzz going. And he took all of that away from me, and it took a full year for me to let go of that muscle memory. A full year. So we took a year stripping everything away, and that second year that I was with him, he started really replacing it with the breath. And then I was out of the studio, but I stayed in Houston for a third year so that I could continue working with him. And I think I needed that last year to start trusting everything we had built up. So for me, it was an absolute three-year, full-on intensive project. And now I get to see him maybe twice a year. But the foundation that we laid was so strong that I've been able to carry that technique with me through these years.
And that was just the beginning of people telling you that you couldn't do it. There was the competition judge in London who said, this contender has nothing to offer as an artist.
Yeah, that was a big moment. And he's since gone on the record saying that he thinks I misunderstood what he said, that that wasn't exactly what he intended to say.
I think we can name him. It was Graham Johnson.
Graham Johnson, yeah. Yes. He was the head of the panel, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I will say that he has contested the way that I phrased this and that he did like my audition and things, but there were some things missing. And, you know, I don't bear him any ill will at all. And ultimately, what he said or didn't say, or what any judge or audition panel said or didn't say, ultimately what matters is what I took from that experience. My impression from that was, okay, they think I have nothing to say. So there must be an element of truth in that. Why would they say that? I had to ask that question. I mean, it was a couple weeks of crying, and okay, I was bitter at the beginning. But then, you know, then time goes on and you learn. And I really am not bitter in a way, whether he said it or not. In a way, it was the greatest gift that could have come to me, because I said, well, I'll be damned if anybody's ever going to be able to say that about me again. And I had to look inside myself. And in essence, you know, I think there was a lot of truth to it, because I arrived, I was probably 28 at the time of this competition, and I was acting like an opera singer. I mean, the hand was on the piano, my posture was just so, the hair was just done up just perfectly. I was well coached, and everything was spot on exactly as it should be. And I couldn't understand why I didn't win. You know, and instead, I was sort of regurgitating and presenting a well-coached product instead of letting myself shine through. This goes back to the first question that you asked me about peeling away the layers and letting myself be vulnerable on the stage, which means being open to criticism and failing and missing a note and, you know, not being liked by everybody. But I'd rather do it as myself than sort of acting like a diva or putting on a persona.
7 New York agents turned you down.
Yeah, if not 8, yeah. They know who they are.
And
it's funny, some of them now will come up and go, gosh, I can't believe I didn't get it. It's like, oh, well, everything works out.
And you'd missed out on Placido Domingo's Operalia competition in 1998, but it was there that Simon Goldstone, a London agent, heard you and took you on, and then took you on an endless round of auditions, and 12 times more you were turned down.
Exactly.
You've really been round the track.
I've paid my dues, I think, yeah.
How do you cope with all that rejection? Before you're even started, everybody is slamming the door. How do you cope with that? I mean, were you having therapy? Were you seeing someone? Where was that strength coming from?
Well, again, maybe my naivete, my ignorance, my blissful ignorance. I did these 13 auditions in 16 days. I'll never forget it. It was December, too. And it was Glasgow, Scotland, to Seville, to Antwerp, back to London for E&O, Nancy. You know, it was good company, sort of mid-level. And they all gave me very polite rejections. Yes, we think she's interesting, but we have nothing to offer her. We don't have anything to, we'll keep an eye on her. And I didn't have any other choice other than to keep going, because my plane tickets were already booked and I had already prepaid the hotel. So I just kind of continued on with the tour. And Simon had prepared me at the beginning. He said, look, if we get one or two offers out of this, that's great. So I wasn't expecting, you know, 12 offers, but one would have been nice. So I was quite low, I have to say. And my last audition was for the Paris Opera. And I was tired, I was broke, my back hurt from dealing with my luggage and all these planes and everything. And I think I sang the same audition. Maybe I cared a little bit less, because I was like, you know, if Nancy didn't hire me, like Paris really will. And 2 hours later, I had an offer for the new production of The Barber of Seville. And like that, my fortune changed.
And during all this time, you're also having to cope with the breakdown of your marriage and 9/11, and your parents are in poor health.
Yeah,
and dying.
That was spread out over a little bit of time. 9/11, breakdown of my marriage was sort of tied up together. And I think those were the formative years that I really had to make some decisions for myself. I, for a long time, was the good Midwestern Catholic girl that was doing everything I thought I should be doing. And I felt like I was living somebody else's life according to other people's standards and other people's expectations of me. And I think somewhere in those years, my early 30s, I finally said, you know what? This is going to get really exhausting trying to please, you know, the people in my family or stay in this marriage that I don't think is the right thing for me anymore, which was not at all an easy realization or easy, it was immensely painful. Finally, I think got my feet on the ground for myself, deciding to follow my own life and start owning it. I actually realized one day it's quite ungrateful of me to downplay what I do. You know, who knows how long this will last? The vocal cords, you know, the voice is quite a precarious thing. Tastes can change in the opera world. If I don't enjoy it now, my God, I want to make sure I'm enjoying it now and owning it as the person that I am. Happily, I think I got my feet pretty firmly on the ground when my parents' health really went south, and I lost them both within the period of 5 months, which was a big shift. It was a big shift for my life, an indescribable loss that surprised me because I was a very independent child. I didn't rely on my parents for money or, you know, I didn't go to them when I had a big decision to make. You know, I was very independent, and boy, I was proud of that. And I think I pointed that out to them on every occasion that I could, that I didn't need them. So the sense of being an orphan suddenly really, really surprised me.
What did success feel like after all of that? You wake up in the morning and there's somebody knocking on your door. The hotel is probably still a 4-star. And they bring you the newspapers and the headlines say A Star Is Born. What did that feel like?
Well, it's wonderful. It's amazing. And I continue to pinch myself that I'm the recipient of that.
A lot of people can't cope with it. A lot of people have breakdowns when the success finally comes.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Give me time. No. You know, I think part of it is I have a very self-deprecating attitude towards things. I know that this success, I can finally admit that the success has been born out of a lot of the work that I have done. I also think that I have a pretty clear picture of what the success means. You know, as quickly as it comes, it can go away. And certainly the next Rosina is coming up behind me and the next Octavian as, you know, I have been a successor to other people. I know that I'm a part of a link, a chain link, and I'm just one link. And I will have my moment, and then that moment goes to somebody else, and I'll go on to the next phase of my life. And I work pretty hard at trying to keep it in balance and in perspective. And at the same time, I make sure that I'm enjoying it. I make sure that with this perspective and this knowledge that it's probably a temporary thing, I want to enjoy it. And I want to go out and relish, you know, the audience has paid tickets to see me and to hear me. I think that's a cool thing. And, you know, I never want to give less than my best, which, you know, some nights will be better than others, but at least that night I've done my best.
Rossini, your bedrock composer, was never totally box office. Marilyn Horne, talking to me recently in this series, said it took an American to show the world in her time that he was a great composer. You've sort of extended that line, haven't you? There was Marilyn Horne and now there's Joyce DiDonato.
Oh, wow, that's lovely. I love that she says something like that. I just love it. Sometimes I downplay everything that I do and then you hear a diva like that say something. I just think, good for her. Leontine Price one time told me, I said, Miss Price, you know, do you still listen to your recordings? And she said, oh, my darling, sometimes I, you know, pop open a bottle of champagne and I just revel. I loved my voice, you know, and you just think, that's fabulous. I love it. You know, there is no mistaking the legacy that Marilyn Horne left and the road that she forged, the Semiramides, the Tancredi, Italiana. You know, I think Barber was always in the repertoire, but she was able to pull out these other real rarities at the time. And you see the audiences in these wonderful YouTube videos, and they're all just there with their mouth open, like, what are we hearing? And it's an extraordinary gift that she gave the world. And she was, of course, in this time, you know, with Caballé and Sutherland, and they could just explode into this world of bel canto. And I'm very much aware that I'm reaping the benefits of that. And, you know, right now I think we have this plethora of Handel singers and Rossini singers. I'm sorry for the Verdi lovers. You know, everybody says, where are the Verdi baritones? Where are the Verdi sopranos? You know, these things go in cycles. But I'm very happy that I'm living in the day that I am today. You know, with, gosh, the tenors that are out here right now to sing, you know, Larry Brownlee and Juan Diego Flores and John Osborne. I mean, so many wonderful Rossini tenors that we can really sort of revel in this wonderful music.